Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
And welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 354. We are doing it again this year, the second annual Course of the Force leading up to San Diego Comic-Con. It is a charity event we do for the Make-A-Wish Foundation with Lucasfilm, where we basically run a lightsaber, Olympic torch style, all the way down the California coast. Last year we started in Santa Monica and then up in San Diego. This year we are starting at Skywalker Ranch. So if you go to starwars.com/Course of the Force, you can sign up. That money that you pay for your run segment goes 100% to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Last year, we were able to grant around 1,000 wishes for Make-A-Wish kids. And so we are aiming to do better this year. So come and cosplay. We have parties along the way. It'll be 7 days, July 9th through the 16th. Again, starting at Skywalker Ranch, going down the California coast and hitting San Diego. So join us. Now, this episode of Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock is basically a website where it's an archive of the most amazing video, stock footage, anything you need if you're doing a website advertisement, multimedia presentation. You can choose from over 700,000 high-quality video clips, 2D animations, 3D animations. They have clips in digital formats, HD. They add 10,000 video clips every week. So every time you visit, you're going to find something that you're into. So you can search, you can drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor. You're going to find the video assets you're looking for. So don't spend a lot of money to have to go out and shoot your own stuff if you just need something for a presentation. Go to Shutterstock.com. There's no credit card needed. You're going to sign up for an account. You're going to start using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project would look like. And then save your video selections you find to your clip box. And once you decide to purchase, use the offer code NERDIST5. New accounts will receive 30% off any package. That is Shutterstock.com. For 30% off new accounts, use the offer code NERDIST5. This episode is Rod Roddenberry, son of Gene Roddenberry, creator of a show called Star Trek. It's a sci-fi show from the 60s. That you may have heard of. Actually, Into Darkness opens May 17th, but Rod came on with John Champion, who hosts in the Nerdist Network Mission Log, which basically they go through episode by episode and break down in chronological order. Well, the plan is to do every Star Trek episode, every iteration that they've ever done. But right now, they're on the original series, TOS, we call it. And they've just started breaking down the second season. So, Mission Log, available on the Nerdist Network. And Rod, I feel like I met Rod many years ago when I first became friends with Ho-Will Ho-Eaton. And so, it was really cool to be able to sit down. It's been great working with them. And kind of an honor to have a Roddenberry podcast on the Nerdist Network. So, here we go. We're going deep this episode, you guys. We are going deep down the Star Trek hole, if you will. Star Trek hole sounds gross, I apologize, but topically, that's what happens on the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 354, with Rod Roddenberry and John Champion, and Matthew Myra, who knows a thing or a million about Star Trek.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Podcast record.
Voice activated now, huh?
Well, we're doing a sort of a Star Trek-y episode, and you're wearing your...
It's a computer. Oh, good.
Are you geeking out?
Expendable.
Oh, nice. Nice. Very nice. Yeah. I got to represent, you know.
Nicely done.
Where's your...
Why are you looking at me?
What do you got?
Where's your Star Trek shirt?
Sorry, I'm just...
Well, he's kind of wearing a future shirt. He's got double buttons on there. That's kind of like in the future when they wear double ties in Back to the Future.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Same diff.
Yeah.
Same diff.
Yeah.
We're going to go to Star Trek proms?
What's his face wear? You know, not Sam and not Ziggy, but the other guy in Quantum Leap. Doesn't he wear like clear ties all the time? He has weird ties. Yeah.
Yeah, there are clear ties. Oh, Christopher Lloyd wore the clear tie in.
Yeah, but he had a double tie, didn't he? Or am I confusing my ties?
He had a single tie.
I'm confusing my ties. I'm confusing
but
my Quantum Leap.
The older McFly had the double
tie. All right.
Tie.
Yeah. Fair enough. Guys,
yeah, that's
fashion of the future. That's what we're here to discuss on the Nerdist podcast, fashion of the future. Call in with your thoughts. One tie, two tie, too many? Go ahead.
Two ties.
I'm listening.
Rod, thank you guys so much for coming back, and thank you for doing the Mission Log podcast for us, which, of course, we'll talk about.
If you haven't listened, you have a mission backlog.
The idea of taking every episode of Star Trek in chronological order and breaking it down seems like a chore.
It is.
Oh, okay, good.
Okay, it's easy for me.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not the one recording it.
Oh, that's very true.
I just get to watch the shows and say, hey.
You pop in every now and then. We'll get the odd text, the odd Voxer message like, hey, what are you going to do with this episode? Yeah. And no. Just leave it to us. We'll talk about it.
Just recently.
We did Friday's Child.
Yeah. Oh, what do you do with that episode?
What do you do with that episode? I don't know. I'm still reeling from
it. These guys did a good job. You know, there's so many times where I look at an episode and I'm trying to be critical about it. And I'm looking at this stuff and I'm trying to pull stuff out of it. And I can't. Mm-hmm. I'm like, all right, so it's fun. But where's the message that all these fans keep talking about? Then I listen to these guys and they do a good job of taking it apart. They're making fun of it.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. They're making fun of it. But they're pulling some things out of it. I'm like, hey, you know, I didn't see it that way.
Well, introduce yourself so people know whose voice is whose.
Right, oh, right. This is Rod Roddenberry.
And I'm John Champion.
And John does Mission Log Podcast, you're now. What episode are you on?
Matt Myra.
Hey, Matt.
Everyone knows your voice.
Oh, Matt's here. Hey.
And they know mine.
And you are? Okay.
Dane Cook.
Oh, good. Wow. Oh. Always wanted to meet you.
Really excited about skipping planes.
Hey, guys, movies are weird.
Okay.
Right. And then I yell. So Mission Log, what episode are you guys on right now?
We're about to record The Deadly Years.
Okay.
And the message in that, spoiler, for those who haven't heard, getting old is a bitch.
It sucks.
Getting old is really bad, so don't do it. That's, you know, have you watched it?
I haven't watched it.
Yeah,
I've seen it before, but that was probably like 5-10 years ago.
So. Right. Yeah. So we're you know, in the early stages of season two, and it's good, but there are some rocky episodes in there. I'm not going to lie. And
piece of the action.
Well, do you think piece of the action is really that rocky?
I mean, it's incredibly campy and enjoyable.
See, there you go. Yeah. It's more like when Star Trek looks like Batman.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you got Nazi Planet.
Yep, that's cool. You know, that was great.
Yeah, yeah. So we were going to hit a few of those.
Yeah, sure.
And then by the end of it, we're going to get to space hippies, which actually I will defend. I'm kind of okay with space hippies.
I had, that was one of the early episodes we did for Star Trek, which is the show I do here at Meltdown, where we watch not the best episodes of Star Trek.
Not the Next Generation.
Just the Next Generation.
Oh, I thought it was,
Next Gen. At Damon Lindelof's request, we watched the space hippie episode.
Okay.
Nice.
Which, let me tell you, even talking over it, not that fun.
Listen.
Well, that's kind of the tough part. Yeah, I mean, that's the charge that you have given us. Me and Ken Ray, who's not here, but Ken, who's my co-host on Mission Log, is to watch every episode and try to figure out just what the hell is it all about. So we'll watch it. We'll make fun of it. We'll call it out for having terrible pacing or terrible effects or whatever the case may be. But we'll also praise it when it's really good. And then we spend the last part of the show trying to figure out what are they trying to say. And very often, there's not really a message, but there's kind of an interesting character exploration or an ethical dilemma or something like that.
Yeah, really, to that point, when I watched them as a little kid, I just enjoyed them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd meet all these fans and they say, Star Trek changed my life. I had messages, had meetings, and I was very impressed by that. So we are going back, we're watching them, but I have to say I'm really kind of, I don't know if disappointed is the word, but a little surprised that they don't have all the messages that I thought they would. They don't have as much.
Well,
sometimes there's moral dilemmas.
Yeah.
But, you know, every now and then there's some good ones. They're not all great.
You find yourself, I think you find yourself remembering the good ones. I mean, you just remember, you know, Spacey.
Well, and here's the thing, though. But when we get to the end of it, so I really want to do this. At the end of the original series, and then at the end of Next Gen, at the end of Voyager, and every series, we want to do kind of a look back and figure out what are the big themes here. Because Ken and I are having this constant argument on the show, much to the chagrin of our listeners.
John?
Yes?
What is happiness?
Yeah. See, that's where we are because
Frozen.
Captain Kirk.
Just wait till you get to Brain and Brain. What is Brain?
Oh, no. I just watched that the other day. Yeah. No, thank you. But yeah, Kirk will just come in and go, oh, okay, this is a happy, though not progressive, group of people on this planet. We should take away everything they have. We should destroy their computer. We should take away the spores that are making them happy. We should just stop whatever it is that's making them happy so they can fight to be happy, so they can struggle. You know?
They can earn it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it would be so much better to earn it. And you know, Ken's very much on the side. Like, if there's a spore, if there's a happy spore for him to take, he'll take it.
Yeah.
If you can upload his consciousness into a robot body, he'll take it. He's there.
Oh, I'm on board.
I'm not. Are you there?
I'd gladly be one of Mudd's women.
Okay.
One of Mudd's women?
Yeah.
Sure.
Would you?
Throw me in whatever body you can.
Would you want to live in the Nexus?
Yeah. Wouldn't you want to live in the Nexus?
No.
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 Not at all.
I got news for you. Whoopi's not always there.
Okay. Well,
in your
case.
Nexus, she's not there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Why would you not want to live in the Nexus?
Well, the Nexus may be its own. We'll get to that one. But
welcome to the Nerds Podcast. We're there now.
Okay. All right. We're there. All right. But if you look at all these examples, the spores and the robot god Val that's controlling the people in the Apple and all this stuff. And Kirk goes in and basically says, this isn't real. So you can't have this. And the Nexus is one of those examples of it's not real. And, well, some people impose themselves into it, but some people are thrown into it without the desire to be there. And once they're there, what do? Captain Kirk rides horses.
The Nexus was real.
Well, the Nexus was real, but Kirk's experience of it wasn't real. He was just sort of there going like, oh, wait, I was frying eggs, I was riding horses, what do I do now?
He would have been content, though, had Picard not shown up and ruined it.
But when Picard showed up and said, hey, remember you used to save the universe?
Yeah.
And Kirk's like, yeah, I used to do
He's
that.
Like,
that's
Professor X.
Cool.
But then what he could have done had he thought about it would have been like, yeah, you're right. And then just imagine himself on the bridge of the Enterprise and then everything's happy. And
so it'd be like the Nexus version of the bridge.
Yeah, he'd just be on the bridge. Yeah, maybe.
Actually, way too meta.
Professor X wasn't. Yeah. Professor X was bad. It was like, weren't you in Dune? Like, that would have been a better one.
That's where I remember him from.
Or Excalibur.
Yeah, Dune or Excalibur.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they cast him for the Next Generation, that's how I remember the guy from Dune.
Wow.
Is it?
Yeah. All right.
Patrick has looked the same
for 30
decades.
Years. Yeah.
Like, exactly. When you look at him in Dune or you look at him in Excalibur, he still looks the same.
Well, it's funny too is if you read like his bio that came up on one episode of TNG, his age wise, Captain Picard, by the time Nemesis is happening, the character of Jean-Luc Picard is like 78 years old.
Oh, wow.
By the time that's happening, because he's that old.
Did you see that picture going around the internet? That it was a picture of Janeway.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was Shatner. It was Kate Mulgrew. And I forget.
Avery Brooks.
And then Jean-Luc Picard, Patrick Stewart. And it said, like, you know, which Enterprise had a gym? And there's Patrick Stewart looking fit and buff at like 80 years old or whatever. He's not 80, but he's in his 70s, right? He's getting there. And everybody else is looking a little worse for wear.
The one that I saw that was going around on Reddit the other day was how to piss off four groups of nerds in one picture. And it was it had a picture of Patrick Stewart and in quotation marks it said, use the force, Harry.
Yes,
and then underneath it said, Gandalf.
right. Love it. Yeah.
But do you think, I sort of look at Star Trek as, and not to always throw, well, I'm not even, the Star Wars Star Trek thing, I don't know why that's become the dividing thing where people are like, or you know, because I get interviewed a lot, and they're like, Star Trek or Star Wars? And I'm like, they're not the same. One is a fairy tale, and the other one is basically a sociopolitical military show, where it's kind of like, hey, for all intents and purposes, I know it's the United Federation of Planets, for all intents and purposes, the United States
right.
is going around
where's NASA?
The sea of the galaxy and just instilling good old-fashioned American values in people who usually don't want them.
Right.
Well, those Nazis needed them.
I think I said on a recent episode, we will civilize you until it hurts.
Yeah.
And that's the mission of the Federation at that
point. And yet,
point.
I love... I was a big fan of what... When they went in and just added some light, they just tweaked the effects a little bit and released. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that series had a particular name, but it was basically they took the first season of the original Star Trek series, and they did a very low impact freshening up of the effects with just some light CG, which normally would scare the shit out of someone and go, "What do you mean?" But then you see it and you're like, oh, it's just for the wide shots of the ship. It's just for some shit going on in the background of the bridge.
Phaser shots, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It all improved it.
Changing the little rolling dials, making digital readouts.
Stuff in the background.
Did they make Greedo shoot first.
They did
no point did they go in and change anything like that.
I love those. I mean, because when we watch the show for Mission Log, I mostly watch those. I mostly watch the HD. And then you go back and you watch the old ones. Went to a TOS marathon where they watched every episode in order over the course of like four days or something. But they were watching the originals.
Wow.
And the effects, they don't always hold up, you know? I love a model over CGI any day of the week.
Sure.
But, man, these are a little...
God, those mods, they just like totally switched to CGI and Insurrection, and those shots look terrible.
Yeah. Well, in Voyager, they did the same.
They kind of crept in.
Not as pretty.
Yeah.
But this whole thing is kind of not just the idea that you're going through and doing this, but it must be interesting for you, Rod, because I know we've talked before, and, you know, I think when you were young, your relationship with your dad was a little strained. And as you got
older. Most of us, I imagine.
Like most of us.
Yeah.
He's, it's your dad. He's telling you to do stuff, and you're like, get off my back. You don't understand me.
Yeah.
The classic dynamic. But this whole thing is interesting because you now seem to be afforded the opportunity to get to know your dad in a way that you didn't when you were younger.
It's actually really interesting. I've had a tremendous opportunity because traveling, well, I was going to say the U.S., but the country, the world, and meeting fans and learning about their perspectives in Star Trek really inspired me. And they're teaching me about the show, and not just about the show, but about my father. And, you know, I've got to take a lot of these stories on both extremes with a grain of salt. Because there's people who just praise my father and put him way up on a pedestal. And there's those out there who really didn't like working with or for him. So it's been great to sort of get all of those stories and kind of try to find the man in the middle.
Was he a complicated guy? Was he the classic complicated writer who like just didn't really connect with anyone?
I'd say so. He definitely had a life on the set and he had a life off the set. You know, he had his Star Trek family and then he had his real family at home. And part of the journey that I kind of went on was like, which family did he like more? You know, which child was his child? And so it was kind of an emotional roller coaster to go through.
Well, Star Trek did what he told him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I did the exact opposite.
Exactly.
I did the exact opposite.
I think we just answered that, Rob.
Yeah.
But at what point did you start really trying to, all right, maybe I should try to understand this, or, you know, because a lot of people might have just been like, well, I'm done forever, you know, I'm done forever.
Yeah. It was actually when he died, as upbeat as that comment is. It was at his memorial service, and I was still 17, and I couldn't have given a rat's, you know what, and...
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I did care that he had passed away.
Yeah.
In fact, very much so. However, I still didn't get who he was and what Star Trek thing
was. Gotcha.
So when people went on stage and talked about the show that really inspired them and they told these amazing stories, I was really sort of blown away and I was sort of raw at the moment. So I listened and began to explore and went to conventions and listened to fans. Didn't really get it until around then that Star Trek had this positive impact. It wasn't just science fiction. And so I went on this exploration and became very proud because I'd hear stories about how people would overcome adversity and like limitations that they put on themselves. So whether it was a handicapped person who sort of had a positive outview on the future, or just some kid who was brought up saying that you'll never be able to be something, and then seeing Star Trek and then striving to become that something, to become someone who works at JPL or an astronaut, you know, that really excited me and blew me away, and I became very proud and have since been trying to represent the family name in whatever way that I can.
It must be kind of strange, though, to, I mean, especially if you're a teenager and you're kind of rebellious anyway, and then you have this entity that is essentially a sibling that you sort of feel like, oh, that gets all the attention, and I don't, then you probably don't want to understand it because you're like, fuck that thing. You know, like as a kid, you sort of probably feel that to a degree.
I had a thing with Will Wheaton. We were never at each other's throats, but, you know, I sat down. We had a heart-to-heart at one point talking about how he told me these stories about how my father would like kind of bring him into his office and like give him advice. And he really kind of looked up to my father as a second father figure to his own and had these wonderful stories. And I kind of would hear this and I'd go like, I never got to do that.
Oh, man.
It's not that I never did. I don't want to play the violin so loud, but I didn't have those experiences. So I got kind of jealous and almost pissed off at him.
Yeah.
And we had a great discussion about this and he told me some amazing stories. So we're on good terms.
Oh, good. Yeah. You can totally take Will. I mean, a sweet guy, but he doesn't know how to fight. neither do I. You could take us both. You could throw me at Will and take us both out at the same time. But that is kind of a, I mean, was it, what do you think it was about his brain that was just, was it because this thing that he was making was this idealized?
Yeah. Well, if I can jump ahead, if I know what you're saying here. My father had an amazing life. You know, he was a bomber pilot in World War II and flew in the South Pacific and had like 70 some odd missions. He was a police officer for the LAPD for a while. He was a transcontinental pilot between New York and Johannesburg. And he actually went down in an airline crash. He did not cause the crash. But in the Syrian desert, and he led a bunch of people to safety.
Grain of salt, Rod.
That's right. That's right. He saw, you know, the best of humanity and the worst. So I think he really just pulled on what he'd seen in life, and he read. He was very intellectual. So I think he just pulled this all together and kind of created this idea of the future that just so happened a lot of other people agreed with.
Well, it is when you look at shows like Star Trek or Twilight Zone, you know, like shows that are sci-fi or fantastical in some way, if you do want to say something about the state of humanity, the most effective way to do that is to separate it from reality so that people don't get offended or so they don't necessarily understand, like, hey, this thing's got a message. This thing's trying to give me a message because you're like, oh, what do you mean? This is a space fantasy or... Well, no, the Twilight Zone, what are you talking about? No, it's just a show about a crazy, mystical realm, you know. And so the idea that you can hold a mirror up to society with a fantastical thing is really kind of particularly at that time and, you know, what socially what the country was going through.
One of my favorite Gene Roddenberry quotes is it was in the making of Star Trek. And he says, you know, this is really what it's all about is if you can learn to feel sympathy and empathy for a horta, for a thing that is as alien from you as it can get, then you can start to feel empathy for another human being who isn't like you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the big messages comes out of Star Trek. It's not in every episode. It's not all the time. But that's exactly what you're talking about. You can totally remove the situation by making it science fiction. And then you get it. You know, when Kirk sees a horde and is like, oh, well, this is just a mother trying to protect her babies.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an obligation to make sure that we don't screw this up. You know, and then you go, oh, yeah. This was what we thought was a killing monster, but now we can change our point of view. And I love it when you and I talk about the show, Rod, and you say, like, yeah, this is a show that challenged my point of view, or I wanted to challenge my preconceived notions about something, and I got to do that through Star Trek. Don't always agree, maybe, with what the answer was, but that's really the fun of the show, because it's not always just banging you over the head with something moralistic, but there is sort of a choice or a moment of understanding that comes out of the show.
Well, I mean, I even think at that time, though, just the presence of Uhura on the bridge as a crew member, it must have been challenging to some section of people socially in the, you know, in the 60s. And so that was just an automatic, like, hey, this is, you know, like, tolerant, be accepting, you know.
We always have to wonder, like, Star Trek was on at a time where that stuff was happening in the world anyway. You know, we were just on those baby steps of making sure, particularly in big cities, integration happened in places outside of the South, obviously, before the late 60s. And you always have to wonder. It's like, well, did people watch that and go, oh, okay, yeah, this is what's happening? Or did people who were bigoted backwards, they watch this and they go, oh, okay, well, yeah, that's nice with a TV show. But then they still carry on this sort of backward belief out in their real life.
I don't know, but I think what's important is young people watching it and not seeing color or race or anything and just going, oh, that's just how this is how it is.
Yeah.
And then growing up, just automatically conditioned to be more tolerant than they might have been otherwise.
Well, and I love that they put the Russian on, who could not be of an enemy.
I mean, seriously. Seriously.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
No. And the Japanese as well. I mean, it was
terrible
drivers. 20 plus years after my father had been in World War II.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he made a lot of statements there. It's really interesting because it was the young college students that kept Star Trek on the air, and they were looking at it the way you say. And there's an interesting quote by D.C. Fontana where she says that, basically when the South said, there were stations of the South said that we won't carry your show because it's got a black lieutenant on it. And apparently my father's response was, F off. That's fine. Don't carry it. And I thought that was pretty cool.
That's fantastic.
I didn't know if we could swear on your show.
You can say fuck off.
Can I say fuck off?
Yeah. Okay.
So fuck off, fuck you off. Damn hillbillies.
Fuck off. And then ultimately those stations would have come around.
But what about the episode where they have the interracial kiss?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Let's be honest. Their lips don't meet.
Yeah. It's funny. We had this discussion.
Yeah, we're going to get
since
to
Since I was
that.
A child.
Yeah, we're going to get to
since
that.
Since I was a child,
long.
I'm like, there's plausible deniability here if anything really went down where they'd be like, well, they never actually kissed in the...
There's a little bit of a cop-out. There's two bits of a cop-out because they're under alien control.
Yeah.
All right. So they're not acting out of their own accord. And with the way that camera angle is and Kirk kind of leans
turns her
in
away,
and he turns
her.
And they say that they did it, but
I disagree.
I don't necessarily see it. God, I don't want to spoil anything for Mission Log, but we have to address this.
I wonder how much of this has taken a life of its own. This is something that I kind of wrestle with. You know, how much of the Star Trek... I don't know if lore is the right word, but all the stuff that I kind of pull out of it from the fans, how much of that is there?
Lore is Data's evil brother.
Good call. And Matt wins the podcast.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, and how much has just sort of evolved over the years? And I'm not suggesting one or the other. I'm just very curious to look at that when we're done with the original season and as we keep going.
But we've had this talk where we've said, okay, if you look at the original series and you look at it under the context of just making the show, your father comes in and he creates the idea, but then the first thing you do is hire a team of people who can do this, and the rigors of week to week. Some episodes are going to be horrible, some episodes are going to be great. You hope that some of them have a good idea in them. But then it's not until the 70s that he starts doing the lecture circuit where you really see that he pieces it together as a philosophy. So I firmly believe that the philosophy kind of came second. That the show was happening and they were really trying to cram in all these ideas and kind of looking at the world around them. What do we want to see change? What are the good kind of progressive ideas that are out there? Let's just try to fit it all in there. But then you have to take a step away from it to actually form it into something that becomes a philosophy or a point of view.
And I want to drop in a quick plug here. You just said the lecture series. We just launched a website called Trek Initiative, and it's with Wikia. And on that, we've got some exclusive content. One of those is a really awesome, my father did a lecture at Auburn University, and we actually found a recording of that, and so we have it on the site.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's in these lectures that you're like, wow, this guy wasn't full of it. He actually kind of knew what he was talking about. Those have been probably the most influential to me in terms of like who Gene Roddenberry was, listening to those lectures.
See, I love that he came to Auburn, Alabama in the 70s. And I saw him in Birmingham in like 1981 or 82 or something like that. And so he would go to these places that were not, kind of a little off the map.
So what do you think the show, what do you think the big things that the show got right? And what do you think the big things that the show got wrong in terms of like social commentary?
Well, I mean, in terms
of
the
eugenics war didn't
right. Yet.
It's coming.
Yet.
It's
right. Well, right. Supposedly.
In fact, maybe 14 years too late.
Yeah. I don't, you think about the things that it got wrong. I don't necessarily think it certainly sexism is a tough thing to deal with. And practically every episode of Mission Log, we're calling out some horrible sexism.
Right.
Just totally ignoring the woman's opinion.
Isn't that funny?
Scene,
it's like, we're making a grand statement, all these other things. Yeah. And let's keep her over in the corner.
Exactly.
Totally missing that part.
Yeah, the original series treats women like the next gen treated Worf. It's really killing with the Star Trek fans, Chris.
I'm glad you're going to announce your Klingon initiative.
We got to get them some equal rights, guys.
But you put Uhura up rightfully on a pedestal and you go, look, this is really progressive. You have a black woman in a position of power, not only in a position of power, but there are episodes where they say, you're the only one who can do this. You know, and that's heavy stuff for a crew of 400 plus people, and they're singling out her as the one who can save the day. That's really cool. But then you refer to the other, you know, every yeoman is female, and even Captain Pike, and then Captain Kirk has the same line later on. If I ever find the guy who assigned me a female yeoman, you know, it's like, really? Really? This is what it's come down to? So there's stuff like that that really does not sit well with a modern audience. But
well, is the end of that sentence, I'll thank him?
Because she's awesome. But the things that I'm finding more interesting to deal with are like the episode Who Mourns for Adonai is about questioning God. And Star Trek has done that from time to time, and it's done that better or worse in other times. But that's bold stuff for 1960s TV.
Or blind faith.
Yeah,
You can generalize it a little bit more.
Sure.
But that one definitely.
But you look at faith from different angles, like with Vol, with the app.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that a popular television show on network right now, if they question God, would get just as much shit as the 1960s.
Yeah.
Possibly more.
Yeah absolutely. They would too. People are much more vocal today.
Questioned the existence of God as one of their characters, just as in one of their storylines, there would be a shitstorm.
Yeah.
Press, letter writing, people would go fucking ballistic. So I don't think that's changed.
Well, you can do that a little bit kind of under the radar. You can have a character like House.
Right.
Okay, who's definitely a non-believer, you know, but
House's character is also irreparably broken.
So he's definitely the anti-hero.
He's very much the anti-hero. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't just have, I don't think a hit show would just have like a normal family of atheists.
Right.
Per se.
No.
But they do have them with Mormons. I guess.
You mean Big Love? You're talking about Big Love?
Big Love, yeah.
Yeah. But you find stuff like that, the whole idea of like self-determination, individual freedom, you know, these are the big things that keep cropping up throughout. And then one of the early episodes that we did that I was so impressed with, again, I'll give credit to my co-host Ken Ray, the Corbomite maneuver.
Right.
The end of that episode isn't about Clint Howard looking weird and creepy as a baby alien. The end of that episode is about Kirk saying, no, all right, they just scared us. They damaged our ship. They did all these terrible things for us. Therefore, we have to go over there and help them because now they're damaged. And I forget the crewman who's totally opposed to this, totally terrified. And Kirk's like, no, this is what we do. And Ken made a really great point about how when we espouse these high ideals, and he tied it back to politics today, you know, when we talk about places like Gitmo and all these, it's like, no. If we're going to say that we are better than that, if we're going to have laws, we're going to have rule of law, where we hold ourselves that high standard, we have to act like that. We can't just say that we have that law and yay, America, we're doing it right. No, we have to behave in the way that we say we are better and we are evolved and we are moral. That's the really cool stuff that pops up out of Star Trek to me.
Did Clint Howard do his own voice?
Wait. Who voiced him? I can't remember now. I'm Baylock. I hope you treasure this Tranya as much as I.
You can see the...
Adam Carolla did it in the Shatner roast.
Oh.
No, wait. I'm sorry. They did bring back Clint Howard for that, but I want to say that Adam Carolla voiced it, or somebody did. Yeah.
Oh, that's really funny.
Yeah. It was good stuff.
I don't know if I know I've told you this before, Rod, but when I went to UCLA, I worked at Bel Air Country Club.
Oh, that's right.
Parking cars. Well, I worked everywhere in that club. I worked in the bag room. I caddied. I worked in the parking lot. And I, on a couple of occasions, drove your dad home because they lived around the corner.
Right.
And your mom threw a Christmas party one year. And we parked the cars on the facing the wrong way, and a parking enforcement came by. They were all on the side of the road, but facing in the opposite direction, which it turns out you're not allowed to do. So these parking enforcement people ticketed every single car. So at the end of this Christmas party, we had to walk in with a stack of tickets and be like, thanks. Here. Sorry.
Do we still get a tip?
So I feel like I personally owe the Roddenberry family probably $300.
Well, we can get a check later.
I apologize. I humbly apologize. But I always felt...
I'll tell you what, that wasn't the worst story. One of them was when a car was parked, a yellow Porsche. When the owner came out to it, it was gone.
Oh.
They were putting the keys on the top wheel. And so someone came by, grabbed the keys, took the Porsche.
Hey, look at these cards. They just put the keys right on the wheel. So, they want you to steal it.
So your story is, you're safe.
Okay,
you're
good. Fine. Wow. I'm glad. I'm glad. Because working in that parking lot kept me afloat during college because the money was good. It was Bel Air. Like, the tips were really good. Yeah. And so when
What's your typical tip? That's what I want to know.
Were you a caddy there?
I caddied there, too. Caddies
got a lot.
Yeah, but I hated caddying because I did not like...
dog left, right on the...
No, I didn't. I didn't like carrying the ravine on 10.
Sure, sure.
Because you'd have to go over the bridge at Bel Air. I know what I'm talking about. But what I didn't really like was the seriousness that rich people take the game of golf. I felt too much pressure as a caddy. Like, if I fuck something up, they're going to be really mad, and I can't take that pressure. Because they were really, like, some of them were nice, but some of them were dicks.
Yes,
and you just did not want to. I mean, these were, like, very wealthy, very, privileged points of view.
You know what the membership is to Bel Air? I think
it used to be like 100.
That's a lot.
No, I think it's 300,000 a year.
Now 300 now. Like, to join before it was like 180 or 200 or something. It was fucking. It was
Holy
insane.
Crap.
And so obviously these guys take that very seriously, and I couldn't handle that pressure of being like, sorry, I lost your ball. Maybe don't slice.
I brought a friend in once to dinner. My parents would have dinner there quite often, and they looked at my friend and said, "Who brought the terrorist?"
Oh, Jesus.
Whoa. Yeah. So. He was a little bit dark.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
That's fucking awful.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a bummer.
That was a real big bummer. I don't have many fond memories there.
And I also didn't really enjoy. You know, I was the same age as some of the kids of the members, and some of them, you know, some of the kids were kind of like, "Hey, park my car, keep it close." You know, like that kind of thing. We're like, we're the same age. you didn't earn this. Your dad just...
Every time I came there, I hung out with the staff. That was more fun. Or I went down to the golf course and would like run across dodging golf balls. But that would be my fun at Bel Air Country Club.
Oh, that's fun.
Did you play?
My parents tried to get me into golf numerous times. I couldn't do it. I just like hitting the ball really hard, and I didn't care where it went. It never went straight.
They were really, really into golf. I mean, they were. You have like hours and hours of home video footage of them playing golf.
Yeah.
Riveting. Riveting.
Like all golf video.
All golf.
And so so to answer your question, how much would I make a night? So, you know, you'd make a minimum wage salary, but it was all tips.
Yeah.
So if I worked during the day, like just a regular golf day, you know, I could probably walk away with like 50 or 60 bucks as a, you know, not one of the heads of the parking lot. But if you would work a party, especially around the holidays, there were a lot of parties, you know, like whatever, birthday parties, and it was a nighttime event at the club, you would get a base of like 50 or 60 bucks and then tips on top of that. So as a college student in the early 90s, for a night of running around parking cars, you know, I could make $120, $150, which was pretty fucking great.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at that time, you know, your rent is like, you have a bunch of roommates, and my rent's like $300 a month. So if I work a couple parties, I've got my rent covered. So it was a really fantastic job, even though, you know, I don't know if I ever felt fully comfortable there. But it was a good job to have.
Yeah, $125 closer to that $200,000 membership.
I mean, that's right.
Yeah, obviously. You're almost there.
Well, I put it all into that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Do you guys get to play on any day?
Like Mondays.
Mondays, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got to play on Mondays.
We had Mondays too.
But oddly, a lot of times I did not go back there because I didn't have to be there.
Oh, sure.
So I was like, oh, you know.
They're clever.
I don't have to be here this day, so
just
I'm not going to go in.
10 to 15 years, guess who's going to be a member?
Oh, I'm not.
He's going to be sitting there in the lounge.
You know, honestly, even if I had $1 billion, I don't know if I could do it.
Oh,
I don't know if I could write a $300,000 check to go play golf somewhere.
I will be there. You guys can be my foursome. Oh, you can come on down.
And then there were, you know, there was sort of like rivalries with all. There was like Los Angeles Country Club, and then there was I don't remember what some of the other ones were. There's one in Century City.
There's Wilshire
River
Country
River
Club,
River Riviera, Riviera
Riviera. There you
yeah,
go.
Riviera yeah. Country Club. There's all that, but.
Let's stop talking about golf.
Let's talk about space golf.
There you go.
Did Captain Kirk play golf?
How old was Kirk when he was captain of the Enterprise? Not how old was Shatner, but how old was Kirk? Was 34. He like 35? Okay, 34.
Does he actually have an age?
Well, we're watching the Deadly Years, and he goes, "I'm 34. I'm 34." But he looks like a 65-year-old man. Although I read that Shatner did not want to be made up as old as the others. Like that was part of his stipulation in that episode. He made a little bit of ego at play there. Yeah. He's the captain. He's the star of the show. He doesn't want to look quite as bad. They made D. Kelly look like he was 102.
Question: yes. Does he look better now, or does he look better in Deadly Years?
He looked better in Deadly Years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love Shatner.
He was wrinklier in Deadly Years, I'll tell you that much.
Well, and he was a smaller guy.
He figured out God's gift to wrinkles, which is just get fat and you won't get wrinkled.
Right.
That's the Shatner way.
But
I don't know if that's true.
Oh, well, I better do something about this.
He was, he was his fighting weight back then. But they say he was 34. He says he was 34.
Yeah.
I think Shatner at the time was a year or two older. But, and then they're supposed to age like 30 years every day, something like that. But
in
that episode,
I was like, in warp speed?
Come on, keep up with me. I know you know your Star
Trek.
But
now I just want to see exactly how old
Shatner.
I'm
going to say he was 35 because I think he was born in 1932.
Well, he's 81 now. So, so just go back 42 years. So, yeah, he would have been 35, 36, 37.
They shot it in 67, that episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're all great at math.
Shatner born in 31.
31. Okay, so he was 36 when they made episode. All right.
So he was only playing a couple years younger.
Yeah.
I saw
totally believable.
I saw Leonard Nimoy last night. I went to the EW screening.
And he sang Bilbo.
He did?
That's what I heard. That's what everybody was tweeting about. That he sang.
I was
Bilbo
there
song.
And then I had to leave because I'm leaving town, so I had to. Oh. It's boring. I had to fucking go home and do laundry. Like, I gotta leave.
Did you watch Star Trek?
No, I didn't see it last night. I just hung out with Nimoy and Jeff Boucher and he's really just an affable, lovely guy. He seems like a regular guy that happens to be Leonard Nimoy.
I don't want to. This isn't really to besmirch anybody, but I do have a story just to describe the difference in the two. My impression. I don't know them. I certainly don't know them well at all. But for several years, I was shooting stuff for one of the big convention promoters, Creation, and I remember sitting backstage at Vegas, and it's
the
big day.
The devil.
Sitting backstage, and it's the day that Shatner is going to be on stage. And the day that Nimoy is going to be on stage. And we're there to shoot interviews. I'm filming, and my girlfriend, the lovely Tella Vixen, who is to my left, is doing the interviews. And Shatner, it is insane. It's you're counting down. It's 5 minutes before he's on stage, and there's phone calls being made, and it's this entourage, this whirlwind, this hurricane of people coming in, and they've got him, and he's all worked up, and he's moving around, jumping around, and they announce his name, and boom, he runs in from the kitchen. He's on stage. He does his thing, and then he's gone. And that's the Shatner approach. Nimoy showed up an hour and a half ahead of time with his wife and their dog, and he just sat back there, and he just chatted with us. And he was totally chill and just sort of watching the world go by. And then they call his name on stage and he just sort of wanders up there. And 12-year-old boy in costume had been there all weekend long, goes up to ask a question. And he says, what's your name? And my name is James. Come up here, James. I want to introduce you to the audience. He does this. And then he says, this was in 2008, leading into 2009. He goes, hey, look, when the next Star Trek film premieres, I want you and your family to be my guests.
Wow.
Yeah, and he just totally underplayed it. He's like, yeah, I'm going to fly out.
When he got
Hawaii
on stage, they're like, do you want to get the kids information? He's like, no, fuck it. I just said that.
Get me out of here.
Are you kidding me? Are you shitting me right now?
But that, to me, just sort of typifies the difference in the two. I heard that they're great friends and that they, obviously the legacy that they've shared together is it would be impossible to recreate under any other circumstance. But I just thinking about, you know, how is Nimoy to hang out with? I totally buy that he was chill and just a cool guy.
In the middle of the earth, in the land of the Shire, comes a brave little hobbit whom we all admire.
Oh, what's the next line? Fuzzy little toes. He lives in his hobbit hole and everybody knows him. Bilbo.
Bilbo.
Bilbo Baggins.
King of the Wild Frontier.
His old age.
Bravo. Bravo. Yeah. Bravo, guys.
Yeah. Coming on the Nerdist album, right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
All of them. Everyone, for some reason in the 70s, there was just like a recording renaissance. And it's like, you, pick up a mic. Hey, Ironsides,
right,
pick
right,
up a microphone.
Right.
Like, everyone just fucking had an album or a song.
Well, Shatner did the LSD, right?
Yeah. Well, I was telling that to somebody today. They're like, what is this? I was showing somebody the Bilbo thing. They're like, is this for real? And I was like, yeah, you don't understand. If you were a TV star in the 60s or 70s, you had to make an album. And if you were Shatner, even if you couldn't sing, you did an album. And he did The Transformed Man.
And Lucy in the Sky.
That was on there, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Yeah. And Mr. Tambourine. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man. It's just him shouting that throughout the song.
Every TV star. Columbo, Falk Rocks.
Falk Rock.
Everyone. Yeah,
really,
everyone
had really a bummer when he went electric.
Really ruined it after that.
Falk Rock.
Yeah. But yeah. I don't know what it was. I guess it was just that period where they're like, people will buy anything.
Right.
Fucking
right.
Why not?
Yeah.
What's gonna hurt? Let's just press an album. Fucking people will buy it. Who gives a shit? Did you go to a lot of the conventions as a kid? Did you hit a lot of the?
Yeah, as a kid, but I just saw everyone in costume. I just had a fun time running around. I again didn't get it. So it was like Halloween for me. I just had so much fun. In fact, the best convention I ever went to was one that they had at the Hilton at Disney. And I would always avoid the convention and try to go early to get on the rides. And I went through the turnstile, 1985, and won a car.
What?
I won a car at Disney and was so pissed because I lost getting in front of all the lines.
From winning a car?
I was 12 years old. I was
what did they do with the car?
Old. My parents eventually got it and ended up like selling it to someone. So it was a 1986 Chevrolet Cavalier.
Oh,
the
Cavalier.
Was it a convertible?
Yeah. Hope
was
it was white.
It was red. Cherry red
Cavalier.
Yeah. It was horrible.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
It was horrible.
It was really entertaining to watch you be very uncomfortable at a convention not long ago when a fan came up to the table and they're talking to you and they're talking about Grace Lee Whitney. And they're like, oh, yeah, Grace Lee is great. I remember she won a car. And you're like, oh really?
Yeah,
she won it at Disneyland. Oh wow. That's really cool. No, wait. It wasn't Grace Lee. It was... it was Majel. Yeah, it was Majel Barrett who won a car. And you're like, oh, yeah, interesting. No, it was her son. And you're like, yeah, that's me. And that was my mom. Yeah.
That's always, you win a car, that's almost like Mr. Burns wins the lottery. And everyone's like, what the fuck?
So everyone hates me for, yeah. Everyone's like, out of everyone, who should win?
How is the... how are the fans to you? Are they cool with you or do they feel like you don't get it? Are you, you know, like, are they, how are they?
I pretty much get it all, but they're all really respectful. You know, the I've got the best of both worlds. I've kind of got a, you know, a fairly famous.
Great episode.
Part one or two. I've got the best of both because, you know, I've got somewhat of a famous last name, but I'm not on screen. Like, I'm not a celebrity. People don't know me. So at a convention, everyone's really kind of cool to me. But then you go online and I was just reading something that said, is Rod Roddenberry a douche?
And that was sorry about that.
Yeah, you started that. You like that,
sorry,
John?
Hang on. What was the conclusion you reached after reading that?
I read through a bunch of them, and you try not to take these things personally. And then, you know, a lot of them are like, well, listen, I never met the guy, but, and they make some assumptions. Like, if he's never seen Star Trek, then he's a huge douche. And I'm like, well, I've watched an episode or two, you know. But so they're all really nice to me. But okay. I know there's some out there who just think, you know, he should be doing Star Trek. You know, he's wasting his life.
But wait, but I'll defend you here for a second.
Oh, I don't think I'm wasting my life. I'm very happy with what I'm doing.
Well, no, is that not that? But about the Star Trek thing, like, the whole mission log thing, all of this, this was your idea, and you're the one who came to me and came to Ken and said, you know, it evolved. You kind of originally just said, I want to watch Star Trek. No, but what I mean is, I want to watch all of Star Trek. No, but I want to watch it all, and I want to talk about it. but I want you to talk about it. You know, I don't want to do the work.
Because I know you'll do a much better job than I will.
Right. Yeah, that remains to be seen. But all of this was your idea, and it was from a genuine interest in Star Trek. It wasn't just like, oh, I have to do this because I got to come up with something to do. You know, we rarely ever talked about Star Trek before getting into that. But then when we started, it was like, yeah, you're involved. You send us notes and you send us messages and you're like, hey, just watch this and I don't get this or I love this or I hate that. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, I'm doing the Roddenberry Star Trek thing in my own way.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Your own notes.
Yeah.
So you, when you were coming up with this, when you guys came up with Mission Log, didn't you say that you basically had this archive of stuff, of just letters and things and objects and it's just all stuff that your dad is personal dad stuff.
Yeah, he collected everything. In fact, there's, you know, what's amazing is that he actually would correspond directly to fans. We've got the carbon copied paper that he would type on, and we've got these responses of all these fans that he would talk to. Not every call sheet, but a lot of call sheets, a lot of inner office memos. We got tons of material from, you know, 1966 on. And this is some really valuable stuff. We just did City on the Edge of Forever.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, for years we had had this document that I loved because there's been this feud between Harlan Ellison and my father as to, you know, who did the better version of that. And it was the second draft, I believe.
Yep.
And Bob Justman was writing notes to my father. There's 6+ pages. We've lost like 7th and 8th.
Yeah.
But it kind of just tears the show apart as to why it wouldn't fit the format and why it's not Star Trek.
He starts out by saying, and I just want to point out that the second draft that was due on this date was delivered 3 days late. And then he goes on point by point. But it's really harsh, but it gets funnier and funnier.
Yeah,
and he'll have a paragraph on a description of why something doesn't work. And then a new paragraph will just be like a sentence, like, page 8, section A, made me extremely cruel to my wife and dog.
Yes.
It's like, wow, this is intense. But we have that, and we have a lot of original drafts, which is kind of cool. So you see how a story changed drastically getting up to its final script.
So what was the biggest one of the, what's an episode that people would know that started out as something completely different?
Oh, man. Well, the endings in a lot of episodes have changed quite a bit. There's... oh, gosh.
The Corbinite maneuver, it was a living creature at first, right?
No, that was the Doomsday Machine.
I'm sorry, Doomsday Machine
was a living creature, and that would have totally changed the point of view of the episode. Doomsday Machine, great episode, but it's just about destroying the machine. It's about the Moby Dick story of Captain Decker fighting this machine. But in one draft, it was living. And it's like, well, okay, now wait a minute. Now we have an obligation to try to reason with it, try to understand it. You just get rid of all of that in the final episode. Operation Annihilate, I thought was really interesting. That's the one with the space amoeba and when it attaches itself to Spock's back.
Yes.
Not a great episode. Okay, let's be honest here. Not a great episode. But in the original draft, not only do they destroy the planet that those people are on, there's like a million inhabitants of this planet that are overrun with this multicellular creature, you know, they say, okay, yeah, this is the only way to do it. We have to wipe this thing out and then destroy every trace of this alien. And that's kind of a downer for the ending.
They kill millions of people.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I thought the needs of the many outweighed the needs of the one.
Well, but they found a way around it in the final. Yeah, yeah. So because they're trying to make the case that these aliens are going toward other places, they're going to destroy other planets, and Kirk kind of wrestles with it. Ken and I disagree. I think he's really wrestling with that problem. Ken says, "Nah, he's going to find a way out. You know,
he'll figure it out.
Yeah, he's not going to destroy the planet."
He's very good.
He is.
That captain.
He's been very lucky.
Yeah.
On many occasions.
A lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any Star Trek questions?
That's a very vague question. I have all the answers. What do I have questions?
I know you have a lot of the answers, but was there anything that you were always curious about?
Matt, I think we should have you on as a guest sometime.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
To talk about a show.
Anytime. Yeah.
Spock's brain.
Spock's brain.
Oh, definitely.
Yes. Or space hippies.
Space hippies or Spock's brain. You want to bore me to death.
Way
you?
To Eden.
I
actually want to rant. I just want you on the show and just for you to go off and rant.
You do. Matt's really funny when he's in rant mode.
You have me. Have me on after the new movie comes out.
You're in rant mode. You go into rant mode.
Oh, God. Yeah. Did you guys see it? You saw it?
Haven't seen it yet.
No.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No.
You haven't seen it yet?
No.
I saw it.
Oh.
Who do you know? How do I get in on that?
Damon.
Oh.
Wow.
All right.
You gotta know people. Come on, guys. Yeah. But do you think? Let's see. I'm trying to think of a good question.
Moral struggle.
No, nope, don't have any
continuity question.
There's not a ton of continuity problems for me.
Doesn't even have to be from TOS.
Yeah, no, I know. Listen, I'm racking my brain here.
Why Enterprise?
Why Enterprise?
Here's the misstep.
It's such a cool idea.
No, it's not.
No, I don't.
Because then it just becomes retcon at that point. That's all it is. It's retcon. I don't give a shit. If you just don't throw this fucking bullshit Enterprise that didn't exist until Rick Berman was like, we need more money. And then he's like, I'm going to make this. And then that's what happened.
Wait, I will say, in Rick's defense, he wanted to wait before making Enterprise. He wanted to wait like a couple of years and actually plan out the show. And it was the network and the studio that basically said, look, if you don't do it, we're going to get somebody else who will. We have to make the show now.
Well, that's
it could have been a very, very different show.
I know that the United Paramount network
was very powerful.
Huge.
At the time.
But my problem with that was always that I always felt like Star Trek was always, let's look to the future and let's keep moving forward. And I felt like having a prequel, the stakes changed to there not being really any stakes. Because you know there's not going to be a terrible situation that wipes out Earth or anything like that, because they're dealing with canon that they've already established. So I think that moving backwards and looking at, like, you know, the technology, and it just gets, I mean, I like it. I like it when they find the Constitution class ship. Like, that's fun for a fan to see. You know,
That's fan wank.
But that stuff, it's just like, I mean, you're just like, so you're establishing, no, I will hit the table, Christopher. Back away.
Okay, I'm sorry. You're very upset.
There's just like, it just becomes a thing of like, well, I mean, now you got us looking at this technology, and then now you're telling us that this is the cool, super fast technology, even though it looks like it's from the 60s. Why don't we just leave that in the past and then move forward with the story? Like, I feel like they should have just done something maybe set 20 years after Deep Space Nine and done something there, or maybe done something 10 years after, you know, TNG happened.
But it was all a hologram simulation, wasn't it?
God damn it. Bloated
so none
Frakes.
Of it really happened.
You had the bloated Jonathan Frakes. And God damn it. I love Jonathan. He's a delight and very kind. But really, come on. He didn't fit in that uniform. Let's not argue with that. Don't do it. Just don't do it. Just at this point, don't. That's what I'm saying.
How about we do a tour of a show called Q&A, and it's John DeLancey and Hester Prynne.
Okay.
And they're basically just... I don't know why I just pulled this out. I kind of just broke Kyle.
I'm ready.
No, I don't know. I didn't.
No, but like, I didn't like the idea of moving backwards. I think it should have always moved forwards. I think that was the problem. That was my problem with Enterprise.
Wow.
My problem with Enterprise was that it moved backwards.
You don't want to see the prequel stuff.
I didn't want to see the prequel stuff.
Well, I disagree.
It's okay. You're entitled.
But what about when the movie with James Cromwell with the warp signature where he's
First Contact.
Does that bother you because that's sort of prequely?
No, it's not prequely at all. It's time travel. That's fine.
But you're still going back and seeing.
Yeah, I don't mind time travel. Don't bring me on a story adventure with these people that never existed. Like, there's no Captain Archer, you know? I didn't like it. I didn't like that.
Well,
they
there
went
is
backwards.
Now. I mean, according to the JJ timeline, Enterprise is the only canon Star Trek.
There is this is not for me, it's not a spoiler. I'm just going to say this right now. There's a lovely shot in the new Star Trek movie panning across a desk at Starfleet, where it has all of the ships, including NX-01.
Oh, cool.
So that's in there.
I will say that, like, have you heard this theory about the correct order to watch the Star Wars movie? We go 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, and then 6.
Yeah.
So I kind of have a similar thing about Enterprise. Like, I like Enterprise starting with the fourth season because that is the most prequel-y out of all of them, and it really does tie into the original series, and it's so good that then I was invested in the characters.
I never even got that far.
There you go. There you go. I watched season 4, then I went back and I was like, okay, now I like the characters. Now I like all this stuff. So I can forgive it the really crappy episodes of the first couple of seasons. That's the weird thing about TV now, and particularly Star Trek. I mean, Enterprise was on when internet message boards and internet forums really had some sway and really had a lot of traction. Mm. So here's all the people writing the show and fans maybe discovering the show, finding all this vociferous outcry about how horrible the show and how could they do this. I feel like had the same thing occurred when Next Gen went on the air, there would not be a Next Gen. There would have been season one, maybe season two, and then it would be gone.
I remember feeling a great deal of distaste towards the Next Generation because of my, you know, fandom of the original series. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
You know, but that again, that grew on me too. And I think that it really, everything finds its legs in the third season.
Yeah.
Really, I guess Star Trek's more, everything finds its legs in the fourth season. Because that's when Worf shows up on DS9, and you know, that's when they really sort of figure out the Next Generation. A lot of people say three is the, but I don't, I feel like three has a lot of, it's still got a lot of kinks to work out until you get towards the end of season
three. This kind of goes back to that original question, though, about does Star Trek really have that power, or is it because the fans have kind of, it's kind of this selective remembering of the really good stuff, and they kind of just forget or push to the side the episodes that weren't so good. I think there's a lot of that, you know?
A lot of bad episodes.
I'd say more so in the original series than Next Gen, though.
Yeah, well, but I mean, the first few seasons of Next Gen were really rocky.
Yeah.
You know, I remember watching that the premiere episode, Encounter at Farpoint, just going, oh, really? It's a jellyfish? That's what I was excited about?
Yeah.
No? And then next week, The Naked Now? Really? That's the it's the same episode as I saw before? Next Gen was painful the first season or two.
I enjoyed it. I did. I liked the first episode too.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's an episode that
has a lot more watchable in HD, I'll tell you that much.
I mean, the Blu-rays are awesome. Unreal. Oh, unreal. They're incredible. But I watched it and go, okay, yeah, here's a Star Trek episode with a message, and it is classic Star Trek in that, but it's just seemingly awful.
It just feels more refined and better put together. I went back and watched all the Data episodes because my favorite character for sure.
Mm.
And it just, every episode felt solid. Not great.
Yeah, yeah.
But very solid. I've been watching, obviously, some of these original series ones. And as I'm watching them, you must have skipped
a fistful of Data's.
Or Data's Day.
Data's Day I enjoy.
You do? Because
he's writing to Maddox, who wanted to take him apart. And I'm like, oh, Data, you're friends with this guy. He wanted to disassemble you and take you out of Starfleet. That's nice.
Yeah. Just original series is very blocky for me. We just watched a few episodes where I feel like they just randomly cut some things in.
Yeah. So Freddy's Child, you're just like, oh, why?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying there aren't those episodes in Next Gen, but maybe it's just because there's so many more episodes that I feel like there's a lot more good ones.
Well, there are certainly, yeah. I mean, they had.
And
so
I also
many more
grew
chances.
Up. Sorry to interrupt, but I grew up with Next Gen, it's not the original,
right?
So that was sort of my first, and that's how I got into Star Trek.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just, you know, bias.
Well, yeah, no, and later in life, I don't know when I decided that I was more of a Next Gen fan than I was of the original series, but like I watched the Next Gen, like I've seen that. I don't know how many times. And then, you know what happened? 2 weeks ago, found an episode I've never seen.
What? How is that possible?
It was like they just made it for me.
That must be...
It was, and I was certain I had terminal illness and someone had found my wish.
Wait, which episode?
Yeah, which one?
It was from season 7 where the Enterprise gains consciousness.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not a great episode. But I'll take it.
I'm pretty sure that over the course of doing Mission Log, there's a lot of Star Trek I have not seen. Like, there's a lot of storylines that I know. There's a lot of imagery that I know. I grew up with the original series. Yeah. So, you know, as a kid in the 70s, like, that was Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, and you only knew that cast. And the Next Gen came along, and I was wildly disappointed by the pilot. But I was kind of there for it. But then I outgrew it, and I just didn't care about Star Trek at all for a very, very long time. And I resented Next Gen because I auditioned for Wesley, and some other pinhead got the role, so dummy. I hated that show for a long time.
It was Corey...
Yeah, one of the Coreys.
Yeah.
A jerk. What a jerk.
I was literally a Star Trek, like a closeted Star Trek fan throughout high school, and I actually remember this very vivid situation of like my friend was over, and she opened my closet door, and inside my closet door, I don't know why, but I had a Generations poster in my closet door with half of Picard and half
yeah.
of... She's like, you like Star Trek? And I was like, yeah, I guess I do.
I'm out.
Oops.
Yep. And then I was just like, fuck it. I'm all bored. You know, I went crazy and I just got
the day
DVD.
You came out of the Star Trek closet.
Yeah, it was a great day. I literally came out of the
You know what's really
closet.
Cool is that we interviewed Rob Zombie a number of years ago, and in that interview, he brought his Captain Kirk shirt to the interview to show us that, you know, he was a Star Trek geek when he was a kid.
Oh, Rob used to go to the fan conventions in the 70s.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, cool. he would go, I don't remember what he was saying, if it was like Boston or New York or whatever, but he grew up in Massachusetts, and he would, like, you know, that his parents, his dad would take him, and he would go, he was just a little kid, and they would go and you know, and it was a, you know, he described the event as like it was a mutt, you know, obviously very small compared to today, but it really was.
Well, I was a
he
kid.
Used to go to those.
I was a kid in the heyday of the creation conventions, like 91, 92, 93, like those. That was like, and I would go into Boston and see all the conventions like that, and then I would buy weird videotapes of, like, you know, you'd buy that SNL with Shatner on it. Like, that's a thing you could buy from somebody with, like, a shitty label on it.
I got to say, there's nothing about that that surprised me when I look at you.
Yeah.
Of course, when I think of Rob Zombie, I think a little different.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Are you saying that because Matt's wearing a bright red shirt that says Expendable on it, where the A is the Federation logo?
Exactly. You know, I think he wears his geek proud. I think Rob just really hasn't come out of that closet yet.
Yeah. It's possible.
Listen, I'm all for it. I love Star Trek.
I think when I was about 7, when the motion picture came out, I remember they had the blue long sleeve pajama type uniforms, but then Kirk had that short sleeve white, and I was like, yeah, that's cool. And Shatner's looking good, and he can wear that. I had that, like, 7-year-old John had that shirt, and I remember wearing it to school a lot. And then the one day I got made fun of, it's like it went into the drawer and never saw the light of day again.
Sixth.
And then I went into the Star Trek closet for a number of years, for decades.
In sixth grade, I showed up to a Halloween party with all my friends, and I was dressed as Scotty. Like, that's that was what I, like, made. Yeah. I, like, made, like, a Star Trek insignia with, like, out of cardboard, and then covered it with tinfoil. Like, I made it myself.
Right. Right.
And I was the coolest kid to myself and no one else. But, yeah, no, I mean, it's really, for me, it's just been a thing that's just, like, this been this nice constant in my life since I've, you know, was a child. It's just always been, it's always there, you know? Well, no matter what's happening in life, I can always watch Captain Picard do something that Kirk wouldn't do.
And now they're making new episodes for you.
Yeah, so, I know.
It's very exciting.
Find a new episode. It's like when I found those new episodes of Frasier on Netflix. Netflix is great.
How is this possible?
Cause and Effect is a good episode. Kelsey Grammer is in that as the captain of the Bozeman.
Uh-huh. There are some episodes of shows where I don't know, sometimes episodes of things get buried. And even, no matter how much you think, like, oh, I've seen every episode of this thing, somehow.
Yeah, you always miss something. You're always, I mean, your life will eventually, you're not going to be around. Like, I'm not going to watch even Game of Thrones. You say it's 10 episodes a season, whatever. You're not going to, there's probably going to be a weekend where you forget to watch it or something like that. And then eventually, 20 years down the road, you'll find it again.
Yeah.
That's what you all have to look forward to.
That's beautiful.
Thank
this
you.
This was a beautiful podcast.
I really feel good.
So Mission Log currently, we're running on the Nerdist Network, which is, you can get on iTunes or the Nerdist website, nerdist.com. And you've just started the second season?
We're about 8 episodes into the second season, somewhere around there. So we've got about 13 years to go.
Yeah, you'll be good.
I posed this question to our listeners. I said, okay, when we're done with the original series, we'll do the animated series because it's rad. All right. I'm right. Yes.
But you have to have, like, weird. Oh my God. That the animated Star Trek series, I think it was that Lou Scheimer.
Yeah. It was all Filmation.
Filmation stuff.
It's rad. It's so great.
So just a product of that period. Yeah. Just those stiff upper bodies and the, you know, the cheap, you know, the cheap animation.
It's like animation is supposed to be 17 frames a second, I think. And their
12.
Show, 12? Yeah. Okay, and their shows are about 3, you know.
Yeah. Well, animation should be.
I think it's 6 or something.
Animation.
Like, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, real animation is like 24 frames per second.
Well,
you know, television
now,
animation, 12, and then you would shoot. Yeah. And then, so to do it cheaper, they would just hold on a frame longer. Right. Or there's, like, you know, other pieces would Well, we'll just keep this part static, and we'll just draw.
You get to hear a lot of James Doohan voices all over that.
Yeah, he's throughout it.
And if you're watching old animation and you notice that someone, like a piece of their body, is shaded different than another piece, that's literally the cell layers.
Right.
Like, you can't stack more than two or three cell layers on top of each other, because if you do, the bottom cell layers get dark.
Yeah.
Because they just, you know, they create the, they create the, but I fucking love that too.
Well, so we're going to do the animated. We may double up. We may do like a couple episodes a week or a couple of animated episodes per podcast. And then we do some of the movies. I'm thinking we do some of the movies, Next Gen, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise.
And you should you should go chronologically as far as like date is concerned.
Yeah, but see, that's the hard part because you have so much overlap when you get into Next Gen DS9 and the movies.
But I mean, it's pretty easy to find the original air date. And if you're bouncing like from season, you know, season one of DS9 and season five of TNG, I mean,
we actually have listeners who sent us spreadsheets of every air date, the order, everything. So we could do it, but we got to
I don't think we're going to break up a season, though.
Yeah, and they would just go straight through Next Gen and then straight through DS9.
Yeah, well, we can talk about that.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
I think it'd be interesting.
So we're in it for the long haul. Yeah. It'll take us about 13 years to get through.
And I haven't told you the plan. The plan is after 14 years and we're done.
Oh, God, what now?
We're going to start again. You know.
Your point of view will be different then.
Yeah, right.
You'll have evolved. Oh,
well, you might have another series on your hands.
Oh, I'm not going to have these guys on it. You kidding me? I'm going to be bored to death of them after 14 years.
Get it. Me too.
Is there anything being planned, Star Trek-wise, do they come to the Roddenberry... No.
My father, basically like anyone else in Hollywood, sort of sold those rights in the '60s when he got the deal to do Star Trek.
Yeah.
And so he retained some creative control while he was alive, but unfortunately, when he passed away, that all went with him.
Okay.
So they don't come to us. JJ's team was very nice to sort of, come to us and sort of ask for our blessing for the last movie, and that was very nice of them because that'd been sort of the first time anyone had ever done that.
Oh wow.
So they've been good to us.
Of any podcast that Jonah wasn't here for, this was probably the one that made the most sense for him to not be here.
He fences it, and then he
and then he gets married and takes a honeymoon.
He gets hipster sick.
Well, thanks for being here, you guys.
Thanks,
good to see
man.
You, John and
That's
Rod
great.
And
yeah.
Matt Meyer and everyone else in the room.
Good to see you,
Kyle, sitting on the floor, and Katie, and we got to get out of this hot box we're in the meltdown. We get some air.
Sure. Yeah, I'm on board.
Thanks for having us, man.
In the middle of the earth, in the land of the Shire, comes a brave little hobbit whom we all admire.
He's something,
fuzzy lick of toes, lives in his hobbit hole, and everybody knows him, Matthew.
Oh.
Matthew Myra, he's only 3 feet tall.
I hate the hobbit. I hate Lord of the Rings.
Enjoy your burrito.
Yay.
All right.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code Nerdist5. Nerdist and the number 5.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now, in hardcover or digital editions, wherever you get your books.